We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air this 20th day of March 2012. And we've got a great big show for you today. I should introduce myself. I'm Bill Cable from Mediate Now. And in the studio with me today is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, Bill, and good morning, listeners.
Okay, in the show today, we will be having a special program to deal with closing the gap. That's a campaign, Australia's largest campaign to improve Indigenous health, and we'll be putting a special focus on dads in that program. But before I mention a bit more about that, I wanted to jump straight in and congratulate Warwick and Alison Marsh and all the team at the Fatherhood Foundation on the 500th edition of their weekly newsletter. The Fatherhood Foundation newsletter goes out every week, and it's a free information service for fathers and families. Warwick does a fantastic job in the community, and it's big congratulations from Dads on the Air.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well deserved.
And Fatherhood Foundation, you're doing great work in the community.
Warwick, of course, is a frequent guest on this program, and we might try and catch up with Warwick before too long. But, yes, look, that's a great service to the community, those 500 editions. Now, if anybody would like to subscribe to the Fatherhood Foundation newsletter, if you just Google those words, Fatherhood Foundation, it'll take you to the site and you'll be able to sign up for that free weekly newsletter, and you'll get lots of very good information in that. So that's Warwick and Alison Marsh. Now, getting back to our program today, we are dedicating this to the Oxfam Australia Close the Gap campaign. This is the Australia's largest campaign to improve Indigenous health. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people can unfortunately expect to live substantially shorter lives than other Australians, up to 20 years less in some cases. Babies born to Aboriginal mothers die at more than twice the rate of other Australian babies, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people experience higher rates of preventable illness, such as heart disease, kidney disease, and diabetes. The Close the Gap campaign has attracted immense public support already. More than 175,000 Australians have signed the Close the Gap pledge. Thousands of Australians have written to the federal government demanding action. And tens of thousands of Australians have taken part in national Close the Gap Day events held around Australia. This year, that day is on the 22nd of March, so that's on this Thursday. And the show of public support has already contributed to a shift in political will to tackle this health crisis. So there are some significant and positive outcomes, just a few I might mention. There has been the appointment of a federal minister for Indigenous health. The government has committed to report annually on progress to close the gap, and the government should be held to account for this commitment each year through a shadow report prepared by the Close the Gap Foundation. There is the agreement of state and territory governments and oppositions to sign the statement of intent to close the gap, and there's continued bipartisan support. So it's gathering momentum. It's a wonderful movement, and the challenge now is to translate this public support, political will, and historic mood into sustained improvements in Indigenous health. The aim is to close the gap within a generation. So that's a big task, but there's some wonderful work going on, and just there are a lot of events happening around the state, around Australia. I might just mention a couple. There's Health Screen Day, in which the Land Council, in conjunction with the Gilgandra Multipurpose Centre, is holding a men's health screen day for the Aboriginal community. That's today, actually, from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock at Gilgandra. And in Queensland, at Mapoon, there are activities which will include health and fitness, child and maternal health, and men's health. That's being held on Thursday from 10 o'clock to 3 o'clock. That's at the Apunipima, Cape York Health Council, Redbeach Road, Mapoon, Queensland. So that's great to see a couple of those events occurring. There'll be a lot more if you'd like to check up on that. And in the program today, we will be speaking to Aaron Stewart in Port Augusta in South Australia. And Aaron has been working in the area of the great number of unfortunate suicides for Aboriginal men and boys. He runs healing camps. He's written a movie and a book. And later on we'll be speaking to Craig Hammond in Newcastle, who has been running the Brothers Inside and Brothers Outside projects. So there's a lot to get through today, but before we get on with all that, we might just, as usual, pick a couple of items in the news. Ian, you've got something.
Well, I've actually got something that came to me from Greg Andreessen of the 1 and 3 website. This came through in my email, and it's an article by Angela Mollard entitled A Few Good Men. I'll just read from it. Angela Mollard says, I love men. Truly, I adore them, how they smell, the timbre of their voices, the sexiness of their forearms, their almost universal belief that life is better if you're laughing along to it. Perhaps I've been blessed with good ones, an ex-husband I'd happily still hug, a current husband who brings me to tears of laughter, a stepfather who treats my mum like gold, and many friends who'd be there in spades if my world fell to pieces. That's why I became a little peeved recently when I went along to a feminist forum featuring trailblazers such as Germaine Greer and Naomi Wolf, and found some of them still peddling the man-hating shtick. Far be it from me to take on the goddess Greer, but heck, I'm going to, because I can't sit idly smiling tautly when she comes out with lines such as, I love men, but they don't love us. And I don't swell with sisterly pride when a man in the audience asks how men can be more human and she savagely quips, I could say, that's your problem. Really, is this where feminism is at in 2012, humiliating men and telling them that they're not worth hearing? Doesn't that ideology sound heart-thuddingly familiar? The girls of this generation face a wealth of modern problems that need the smarts of Greer and her ilk. How to love their bodies in a world that doesn't, how to demand equal pay for equal work, how to navigate porn culture so they can have enjoyable sex, how to keep safe in a digital world that could snap and trap them for life, how to hold on to their hair when everyone around them is losing theirs. Bless author Caitlin Moran, whose magnificent book, How to Be a Woman, I'll Gift to My Daughters on Their 15th Birthdays. It's not academic and it's not flawless, but I challenge anyone to read it and not feel like skipping down the street. It's Moran I turned to after my afternoon with Greer. She writes, I don't want men to go away. Loads of stuff they're doing, iPads, the Arctic Monkeys, that nuclear arms deal between the USSR and the US is cool. And they're funny, and I'm friends with lots of them, and they're good for having sex with, and they look great in reproduction World War II uniforms or reversing into tight sparking faces. In Moran's world, men aren't the enemy, and no one wants to take the whip off them. We just want an equal crack at it. Let's face the paternity thing. What we need is manners and mutual respect, and more feminist heroes such as my husband, because while I was listening to Greer, he looked after the kids, mowed the lawn, helped out at a school workshop, and cooked dinner. What's more, and I add this rather sheepishly, it was his birthday. So there you go. And we're not all bad, and there are women out there who are capable of appreciating the damn fine contribution that most men make to not only families, but to the whole world generally.
Yeah, that's what we think feminism should be in 2012.
Absolutely. And, so we applaud all that. That was wonderful stuff.
Yes, and along the same lines, one of our favourite journalists, Elizabeth Farrelly, in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 15th of March, wrote that she wrote in connection with the conjunction of Australian Women's History Month and International Women's Day, which that happened last week, last Thursday, the day of Sydney's great deluge. She notes that it is Australian Women's History Month's stated aim to glorify not their achievements, of which there are disturbingly few, but simply their existence. The group Women's History Month is in fact promoting the work done by a female architect, and this is by the wife of George Taylor. I'm just looking for her name here. Florence Taylor. Florence Taylor is widely celebrated as Australia's first female architect. So our own Elizabeth Farrelly went along to the talk, but the only question she had about Taylor as architect that matters was she any good? But unfortunately, since not one building exists that is clearly and definitively from her mind as well as her hand, we've no idea. And this is where Elizabeth Farrelly says that affirmative action and she come to grief. It's, mind you, I think she says this is downright insulting that that just because a female architect exists that so much fuss should be made when really it should be, the focus should be on what she's actually done. What has she achieved? As she points out, if Frank Lloyd Wright had not in fact provided any buildings, he'd be nobody too, despite the fact that he might have had an architecture degree. In her view, affirmative action insults the very people it is meant to assist. And yet, one of the things where she is on Florence Taylor's side is in her magazine, it's a magazine called Building. She had ongoing criticism of Burley Griffin, and she described Burley Griffin's architecture as freakish, ugly, and absurd. And for that, Taylor is routinely chastised for daring to be critical. Some say this reveals her as uneducated, unethical, and not very nice. But Elizabeth Farrelly says, go girl. All history, men's, women's, or three-headed dachshunds must scrupulously give credit where and only where it is due. And I think that's her main point, that give credit where it's due. If it's not due, don't go overboard just because of, in this case, the author or the architect happens to be a female. It doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to be one of the great architects of this world. And I think Elizabeth Farrelly is saying, you know, you've got to earn it.
Just being a woman is not enough to guarantee you a place in the upper echelons just because you happen to have a degree.
Yep, so that's a very positive article by Elizabeth Farrelly at the Sydney Morning Herald on the 15th of March. Yeah, we might go over to the US for the next story we've got here. And this is a story by Robert Franklin in Fathers and Families. And he refers to a case where a New Jersey woman was arrested for failure to pay child support. Brenda Alvarado owes $9,411 in back child support, and a court issued a warrant for her address. Her new address is the Salem County Correctional Facility. Now, you might say that's no big deal, except that the fact that this article is a rarity in America, and certainly it would be in Australia, because of its the headline referring to a mother being arrested for not paying child support. Now, needless to say, there are no references to her being a deadbeat mum that are so fashionable in referring to men who have fallen behind. But the arrest of a mother is very unusual.
It is unusual. I've got to say, you really don't hear about that at all.
The U.S. Census Bureau's most recent data shows that non-custodial mothers are far less likely to pay the support they owe than are non-custodial fathers. So what's this you say? So fathers pay 61.7% of what they owe, while mothers pay only 54.6%. 42% of fathers pay everything they owe, but only 34.1% of mothers do. But even more interesting is the fact that so few non-custodial mothers are ordered to pay support. Some 54.9% of non-custodial fathers are the subject of child support orders, while only 30.4% of mothers are. So, in other words, fathers are about twice as likely as mothers to be ordered to pay support in the US. Of course, they don't have the child support agency that we labour under in Australia.
Oh dear, but, yes, the Department of Suicide and whatever, what are they called?
So there's but the same principles apply. It's for whatever reason, it seems that mothers are never pursued for child support. Even now, these days, they are more likely to be payers, but it still doesn't happen, and they're never labelled deadbeat mums. It seems to be it's a worldwide problem which we're working towards.
Well, we want equality. Let's face it. All we want is equality, us blokes.
Now, just going back to the states, a bit of good news here. The Oregon House of Representatives has passed a bill by a 37-23 margin, and this bill will make accusations of child abuse that are known to be false when made a crime punishable by a fine of up to $720.
Oh, well, at least that's some step in the right direction.
Yep, the
fantastic.
Bill, the bill is now moving to the Senate for consideration, and the proponents of the bill say that accusing somebody of something as serious as child abuse tarnishes their reputation in a way that is unique. And there's no doubt about that. And also, think of the damage to the child when being caught up in this sort of nonsense.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the real tragedy.
Fines by criminal courts won't necessarily affect custody decisions because it's still going to be the equivalent family court over there. It'd be difficult for a family court to overlook a criminal conviction for making false accusations when they're deciding on where the child's going to live. So
false accusations in every other court, are perjury. You're not allowed to do it. It's simply, it's a crime. So why shouldn't it be the same in the family court?
Yes, I mean, the fact that family courts all over the world do not only act on unproven allegations and effectively place the burden of proof on those accused to prove their innocence, it's they're quite willing to go on unsupported statements and make these draconian decisions that can affect a number of lives. We might go to a short break and we'll be back shortly with our first guest.
I'm a girl. No, no.
welcome back to Dads on the Air this 20th day of March 2012. And our guest this morning is Aaron Stewart, who is the Manager of Aboriginal Projects, Centre Care Catholic Family Services, and he's a writer and producer of the film Yudum and the book by the same name. Aaron is a Fellow of the Governor's Leadership Foundation, and he was awarded the South Australian Great Commendation for Outstanding Achievements and Significant Contributions, demonstrating excellence in regional leadership. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you very much for joining the program. Aaron, I first read about your story in a Crikey article, talking, the heading was Stolen Lives, Crusader Preventing Suicide by Promoting Identity. Now you've got a very difficult job, I think. And I just wonder if you could tell us a bit about your day-to-day work over there.
Okay, I'm funded through Health and Age, and I'm actually a manager for Centrecare and Aboriginal projects here. We do in the northern parts of the Port Pirie Family Catholic Diocese, and one of my main roles is around suicide prevention for Aboriginal males.
And that's a growing problem, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, especially. Like within Port Augusta, in the last 4 months, we've had about five suicides. It could be six, but yeah, around about five. And it gets a bit heartening at times. And it's very difficult area to work with. But also, if you're an Aboriginal person, and a lot of the victims of suicide are Aboriginal, also it gets a bit hard to try and navigate. How do you manage and do your work within a community, especially one the size of Port Augusta and also surrounding areas?
Yes, and the rate is I've seen somewhere is roughly four times greater than for non-Indigenous Australians.
Yes. The suicide rates now are back in 2007, I believe it was 5.3%. South Australia is a small state compared to Western Australia and the Northern Territory, but we do, it's nothing to brag about, but we have got a higher suicide rate in the Aboriginal communities. And mind you, I was just, looking up South Australia, I wouldn't like to look up, the Territory, Queensland, New South Wales and those other states there.
Yeah, it's an overall problem. And are you finding that the victims of the suicide are actually getting younger?
Yes. It's very difficult to try and manage, the suicides and the ages and whether they're attempt suicides. See, one of the main problems I have as an Aboriginal person is you get people within universities or higher education, and they'll try and compare suicide. They'll compare it with another issue like self-harm. And I'm not putting those people down that categorise this to, put people in their special boxes, but I believe if you're Aboriginal, there's no difference between self-harm and suicide or attempt suicide. It's just one. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I'm wondering if you could just explain a bit more.
What I'm trying to say is, first of all, the age rate, yes, we're quite younger, but we're also finding that with a lot of elderly Aboriginal males that are going through, could be dialysis or some health issues or just a separation, a bit of domestics, within relationships, that can trigger. So the numbers quite vary, but yes, quite young. What I'm trying to say in relation to where we take them to, say, the doctor, to a practitioner, and they will categorise these people, whether they're suicidal or whether they're someone's committing self-harm. To me, as an Aboriginal person dealing with these Aboriginal fellas, to me, we shouldn't categorise because of the risk factors of them just being Aboriginal takes them past that point of, he or she's just committing self-harm. If they're Aboriginal and they've got all these high risk factors, we shouldn't categorise them. We should just treat it as they're attempting suicide to come out with a treatment, whether that be navigated within the health system or ascertaining help for them.
Yeah, so it's a really big alarm when you find someone has in fact injured himself.
Yes. And when you ask the reason, they're either usually suffering from depression or even going to court, they could be going for, DV issues. And when you get your psychological assessment of that person, you find out they've been either, child abuse or, been raped by their uncle or, you know, by, you know, a rape or something. So there are other triggers where, you know, that trigger obviously violence and other stuff outside from suicide, then suicide is the last resort.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do they, what sort of self-harm would alert you that there's a real serious, that there's a serious problem?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't categorise with self-harm. If, say if me, myself, as an Aboriginal male and a doctor standing outside and there's an Aboriginal person there and they're cutting their wrists, the professional would say, oh, they're doing self-harm. And me as an Aboriginal person, I say, no, they're beyond that. They're trying to commit suicide.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to say is that we shouldn't categorise, especially on an important issue like this, Aboriginal people, because the risk factors are so high and that puts us more at risk of suicide. And that itself should, we should take every attempt of suicide, every, where someone tries and hurts themselves, we should just name it as, you know, attempt suicide, because if we really want to stop the rate of it, you know, it's a taboo subject, I know, for most, you know, Australians alone, let alone Aboriginal Australians.
Yes.
We should, you know, take it by the horns and, you know, say it for what it is.
Is that, now, you're on the other end of this. You're doing something about it. You do a lot of counselling.
Yes.
So do you just arrive at a community and start talking to the young people, or do you arrange an event, or how do you...
How it is here now, I work in Seneca in Port Augusta, 6 Gibson Street. We've got a lot of counsellors here. Individuals can walk in. They usually have what they call a kitchen sink counselling with me. Bear in mind, I've had males just walking in. They'll come in normal, and I'm glad they'll just say, look, I feel like doing harm to myself. Or when they say that, what they're saying is they feel like killing themselves.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just sit them down and we'll go for a bit of a yarn and I'll get them through that first initial down stage, you know, which is a window of opportunity where suicide can set in. At that moment of weakness when that person is vulnerable, where all thought of life is given up because they are so down, if they've got someone there to support them through that and encourage them, you know, that, you know, every storm ends and there is a shiny side to life, you know, where it brightens up. So if I can get them through that, and then we can get them through into our more professional counselling around, say, around different types of counselling, therapeutic or whatever, to try and help them through the initial stages. In Port Augusta area, sometimes I find it a bit hard because, you know, to be quite honest, with the suicide just passed and stuff like that, even people I don't know, you know, there's a bit of a weep in my eyes because you just sit and think, wish you had the chance to be there where that window of opportunity where suicide has actually crept into their life and split it apart and made them actually do the final act. You just wish you was there to try and save them, you know?
Yeah. Oh, you're doing a marvellous job. And you know, no doubt the fact that you are Indigenous, it helps you to relate to these people coming to you with these problems.
Yes. That helps. And part of my... Indigenous side is I try and create learning mechanisms for our people, and so it's where and I look at this where we mightn't learn so much as how would you say, a lot of Aboriginal people, especially in South Australia and the North, I'm not saying we're not educated, I'm saying that how did we learn before colonisation, you know, how did we learn this and that, and yet, and we were one of the most you know, environmentally, you know, tribal people in the world to look after environment and to work with it. So, but how did we learn that? You know, obviously there's that family structure going up through story, song, dance, law, paintings and all that.
Was it in fact a problem in the Aboriginal community before the white man arrived?
When you think about it, suicide itself is an act of desperation. When no one can't see any way out. I think the question to ask, did Aboriginal people felt like that before colonisations? I believe that our support mechanisms were a lot stronger. So, and I didn't really want to discuss this bit, but to me in the Aboriginal community, it's gone past suicide. You know, when someone passes away now, a lot of people really don't care how they died. It's just, notice that's grief. You know, it's gone on to death.
Yes.
And so, to answer your question, I believe that sorrow camp and in the mechanisms, the infrastructure before colonisation was there, supported Aboriginal people through that process, because when someone dies, then you've got the grieving, the grief, and even that's been lost in our communities today without that support mechanisms like sorrow camps. Like here in Port Augusta, we try and organise a sorrow place where everyone goes and grieves and supports each other. So we try and do things like that. Different families do it. Obviously, we don't do it through work, but I just think a lot of that is lost through, you know, the colonisation process, and I think we, obviously that creates more high risk factors for our people.
Yeah, so you're approaching this from both ends. You're providing support for the families after they've lost someone, but you're also running camps, I think, to get people back to there.
Yes, we've got a healing camp today, actually. We're shooting off up into the Flinders Ranges. We're taking some young kids up into the bush there. We're going to take them through some gorges, look at some sites around in the Flinders there. We're going to show them a classroom, say, like, where there's carvings, and we're going to show them an open-door environment classroom. That's one of the oldest in the world. I think this classroom, they dated back over 40,000 years, 60, close to there.
Really?
It's in a bedrock in a canyon, so when you walk in, it's like you're walking into a cathedral that's, you know, over 40,000 years old. It's got all these markings. So we sit them down there, and we have a yarn. We really make them feel proud, and we tell them that it's okay that if you're finding it hard to learn, you know, the cognitive process of European style, this is how we used to do it. And then from there we go on to the mental health stuff, where we talk about any form of psychosis or just, you know, pure depression. But we cover that in a way, in a more traditional process, within this little bush-style classroom up in the Flinders Ranges. And they really learn about that. And you'd be surprised how it brings out their inner self and how they approach different people, adults that are there, and they have a yarn about stuff, you know.
Yes.
So
they have Aboriginal people have a different way of learning, I think, than the Westerners.
Yes. So that's the whole idea of my program is where it's like this. It's where, you know, as we evolve as human beings on this planet, even Westerners, they become more creative, you know, with multimedia, how information and information gathering and even sharing, and just the learning mechanisms themselves. When you go to uni, there's electronic library, all the systems are changing and evolving. But in doing so, Aboriginal people, especially in this part where they're tribal, semi-tribal, urbanised, we get left out because of the, you know, closing the gap issues like education. We don't get a chance, or, you know, we're oppressed, or, you know, we just haven't got the money for our kids to go to school, or the Centrelink or the payout systems might be inadequate. So then for our children then suffer. And when they suffer, a lot of Australians think that colonisation just happened when the boat landed in Sydney and that was it. But every day when our children or our grandchildren try and learn something new in school, that's still a part of colonisation. That is an ongoing thing. And that's where I think a lot of people fail to see where we need to educate our Aboriginal people as well, but we need to make them feel proud of the teaching mechanisms, and we try and teach them in a way where they understand it, you know, the cognitive processes. It's basically what I'm trying to say. If we take someone, say a professor or something from a university, he or she in that environment is quite a failure with what they're doing. But if you take them out to the bush with an Aboriginal person, who becomes the professor then?
That's right.
Exactly. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is there's teaching mechanisms where we can teach anything, especially about healthy living skills and well-being, and yeah, I just enjoy doing that sort of stuff.
Now, you've got, I think, five pillars of Aboriginal teachings, and that's the ones I think you were just talking about. Is it the song, the dance, the story, the art, and the culture?
Yes.
So you get them dancing? Is that part of it?
You can, but what we try and do, because we've only got them for like 3 days in this part, we try and build more self-esteem. We try and get them to talk about the issues, and that it's okay to feel down, or it's okay, you know, if you've got a, you know, simple little things like teenage pimples coming up and they think it's all strange or something. These issues where they mightn't talk to their parents about or anything like that, we try and encourage them that it's okay to talk to people. And that's one of the reasons why we have these camps. We get them away from, you know, the Nintendos, the Xboxes. We get them out there and we sit them down. We we get the bush tucker stuff and make them feel good about, you know, walking around hunting and that type of stuff in the bush. But then when we sit them down and we get them at that level where we communicate, you know, the trips, the camps we do are quite, they're quite movable, means we always move. But when we sit, it's downtime for them. And, yeah.
Look, my impression of the Aboriginal people is that they're a very shy group. So is that another barrier to getting them to open up in that way?
Yeah, look, I tend to agree with you there a bit, but then I also think that our communication methods, you know how we people want to do cross-cultural training? We can, a lot of people think, yeah, you can learn about the culture, but then again, how do you communicate with an Aboriginal person if he or she is shy, if he's, you know, sitting down? I think that we're not shy. I think some of us have just been that much oppressed where we pass down, you know, it's like not Aboriginal people. If policemen come to them, they say, hey, look, our policemen come and get your welfare. Or you it's when you're a child, it's bred into you that, the you know, there is a higher fear than what you are or than mum and dad. And when other people around, I think a lot of that is because, you know, we don't understand it, but there is a form of, you know, I don't like saying this, but there's a form of oppression upon Aboriginal people in Australia.
And do you find it's better to work with the young people than, say, the parents? You know, I think sometimes there's a problem when the parents see the child doing something they're not familiar with. They might be inclined to talk it down. Do you do any work with the parents as well as the kids?
So, yep. My job is usually initially with Aboriginal males, but I have went and spoken, did presentations to female groups, a lot of nanas and a lot of mothers, and I have worked with a few of the parents. We mostly, they actually ring up here, and you'll find that the either mother will ring me or the grandmother, especially when it comes to their child. And, you know, suicide, a lot of parents don't like the word of that, especially when it's their child, because as a parent and you've got a child that has mentioned that they want to kill themselves just by simple notes or something, you know, for a parent, that's the most loneliest place you can be. You think, where do you go for help? You know, what do you do? Yeah, sure, there's Lifeline and those, you know, telephone call centres and all that, but at that particular moment, the stress also on that parent from that child that wants to take their life becomes suicidal itself. Mm. And it is a lonely place for any parent who loves their child so much. So we try and offer support to them by, if a parent will ring me here, I'll fly around to the house and have a yarn to them and the child, and then it's measuring, you know, who's more measurable here at a higher risk, you know, especially if the Aboriginal, is it the child or is it the parent? So, yeah, I just, yeah.
And in the Aboriginal community, it's a little bit different from the Western in the sense that the role of nanas and uncles and you know, it might necessarily be the biological parent who has the primary role, as I understand it.
Yes, yes. So in many families, because of the broken mechanism through obviously the assimilation process in the early days, now the more role model is from usually the nanas. And the grandfathers, so yeah, and they take a leading role in supporting the children. We've found through studies that if you know that most nanas believe on the female side, usually when they're you know over 50, they're not you know that they very rarely think about suicide because obviously grandparents live for their grandchildren and there's a care factor there. But the more vulnerable ages are, you know, obviously a lot younger than 40 and obviously early teenagers. So, yeah, and the how would you say it, the mechanism that structures, you know, how would you say, the family respect for will come from the elders.
Yes. Yeah. Now, we're speaking with Aaron Stewart, who's the manager of Aboriginal Project at Centre Care Catholic Family Services in Port Augusta. Now, Aaron, you've produced a book and a movie.
Yes.
Reviewed them.
Yes, Yadam, yep.
Yadam. I'll get the pronunciation right in a minute. Now, this Yadam touches on a lot of universal issues for Aboriginal males. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about the story.
Okay, well, I've written 5 stories, actually, about Yadam. I was thinking, how do I communicate to Aboriginal people? Like, at first it was about males, but then I thought, how do I communicate to the, you know, sisters and mothers and grandmothers of these males, and how to communicate to these children of these males? And once again, I thought, we can do it by story. So I've written 5 stories, and at the particular time, I wasn't going to even go into a movie, and someone suggested a movie, so we've put it both onto we did a small 30-minute story on a DVD, then we did a full movie in an hour on this movie. It's about an Aboriginal male, you know, at a particular time, part of his life, you know, going through life. But the good thing of the movie, it's everyone's involved, nanas, aunties, you know. We've opened it in Adelaide in South Australia. Well, I was quite shocked with the response. It was mentioned in our Parliament twice. So it got some good feedback.
Yeah.
It was shot up at Oodnadatta. 3 months before we got to Oodnadatta, there was a young suicide there. A young girl took her life. She was, you know, very, very prominent in the community, very, very good, you know, doing things. And we went to the community, a little other side of the dingo fence there, and asked if they wanted to be a part of this, and the community all got behind and backed the project. And we, what usually takes about 8 or 9 weeks to shoot, we shot within a week. Lost a lot of sleep, but yeah, and we put it all together, and we are happy with the product. It's now been nominated for an award at a best feature film in South Australia here.
So
we're going to see how that comes on. But it wasn't done for that. It was done for to help Aboriginal people.
Yes.
And because it obviously I wrote it, and I'm a producer of it also. It when you watch it, it's got those elements what I spoke to you about earlier about sorry camps and that sort of stuff on there, like in the movie itself.
Yeah.
And it's for Aboriginal people, but from what I gather from, you know, non-Aboriginal people, they quite like it. There's some humour in there. There's some sad times also, but, yeah.
Now, Aaron, for people that are interested in that DVD or the book, can you tell us how they can get a copy of it?
Well, they can either ring here in Port Augusta. They can ring area code 08-864-12379. Or they can ring Cinecare Central in Wyala, and the number there is 86442030, area code 08.
Okay, so what was that again?
86442030.
Right, and that's the Port Augusta Central.
No, that's Wyala Central.
Oh, sorry, Wyala Central.
Yeah.
And that's people can get copies of the DVD and the book.
Yeah. The one thing I must say though, because I've written 5 stories about the one fictional character, the book itself is a story before colonisation. So in that first book, it talks about how did we heal ourselves? You know, what mechanisms were in place nowadays if we get down or depressed, we go to a doctor, you get some medication and all that type of stuff where you get counselling to help you. But in the first story, it's all about environment and the traditions, what we did to make ourselves better and what was in place to support us. So the second story of the movie we shot is more contemporary and it's about today's life. So yeah, there's 2 different stories there, yeah. Just thought I'd share that with you.
Yeah. And look, you just mentioned about that young girl. I suppose that must be the shock when, you've talked about people that harm themselves, it's an alarm, there are no doubt other signals when people might be contemplating suicide, but I guess there are those other ones where there's just no sign at all and then the person's gone. Does that happen, do you find that happens as well?
Yes, there's, you know, with suicide, if you're suffering depression or, you know, some form of psychosis, you know, obviously you're more high at risk. And once again, if you're Aboriginal, you're more high at risk. I think suicide, it depends, like, if you're in a relationship and where you might have a bit of a disagreement with hubby or, you know, with your wife or whatever, then where something might come in and you might just walk out of that relationship thinking there's no need to go on, you might just, you know, go and take your life. To me, that sort of suicide is the spur of the moment where the window of opportunity has increased for you to take your life, for you to start thinking. Then there's the suicide where someone is really suffering deep and down inside, where they feel so alone and they can't see any way out, and the pressures of life or just the problems of life and how they look, how they're treated within the community, that's a build-up, and then they start thinking about suicide. And then when they start thinking, they either start planning or they just think about it now and then, and then where something actually happens in their life that triggers the final act of it. So, yeah, I look at that as two different elements.
Yeah,
and obviously, so, you know, it's, how can I explain it? If you've got a very evil, nasty person and they go and hurt some good people and they carry out, and they carry out crimes, stuff like that, and doing the process, then 2 days later, they find out that they've done wrong. You know, then they take their lives for it. You know, obviously they've done wrong, but they come to their senses and they take their life because of the guilt. That's that type of suicide. So there's different forms of suicide, I think.
Yeah. Aaron, it's must be harrowing work. I hope you occasionally take some time out to catch up with your own culture and do a bit of fishing and get back to normal.
Yeah, I'm from the desert pass, but yeah, you're right. I'll be eating a bit of kangaroo meat cooked in the ashes, and you'll probably use some camp oven red wine, put a bit of garlic butter in there and some onion potato, and have it with a hot fluffy damper, mate, and some little butter on that.
I wish I could join you.
Yeah, no worries.
Well, Aaron, we're just about out of time.
That's okay, mate.
Could I thank you very much for being on the program. It's been absolutely enlightening. Now, you've chosen a song for us. Any reason why you chose this particular song?
I think everyone needs to pick up. I think in life we're giving gifts, and those gifts are the natural things we don't, you know, we take for granted. When we laugh, we're happy. When we're down, you know, we're down. When we're sad, we cry. But I think what needs to happen is everyone needs to care for each other, because it's a lonely life to be on the path by yourself. And if someone needs to pick you up, and it's amazing, you kick 10 goals in a footy game, everyone's on that path shaking you on the hand, you know, clapping, you're the legend of the game, everyone's there. But when you're down, no one sort of, there's no one with you. So I just think that, you know, we should support each other and get on the same highway.
This is the Blue Highway, yeah.
Yeah, mate.
And you're on your own. Blue Highway by George Thorogood and the Destroyers. So we'll let George take it away. Aaron Stewart, thank you very much for being on the program today.
No worries.
We wish you all the best in your very important work in South Australia.
Thank you. I do appreciate that.
Thank you.
People don't pick you up on the blue highway. The blue highway. You travel alone. And people don't pick you up on the blue highway. Yes, the blue highway. You travel alone. Sunshine out.
grows so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air. And welcome back to Dad's on the Air this Tuesday, 20 March 2012. And our next guest is Craig Hammond, who is the leader of the Indigenous Programs at the Family Action Centre, University of Newcastle. Craig Burkey Hammond grew up in Moree, New South Wales, and growing up in the Aboriginal community gave him that sense of belonging and allowed him to develop skills in doing things the blackfellow way. He's been favourably described by Dr. Richard Fletcher as being able to conduct the very good seminars because of his reputation and his skill. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome Craig Hammond to the show. Craig, good morning.
Good morning, and good morning, listeners. Yes, thank you for that introduction.
Oh, Craig, Burkey. Can I call you Burkey?
Yes, no, that's fine.
Great. Now, Burkey, you've in particular were interested in the Engaging with Fathers program that you've been working on up the Family Action Centre. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that.
Well, it's a program that's been running. I first come on board in 2001 with the Engaging Fathers project, and that was basically around trying to engage dads in a primary school setting, also in early childhood. That was because the school system is predominantly female.
Yes.
But we wanted to look at how can we get dads actively involved in a setting that's not usually the environment. So I've been doing that for a while now. And my main role was specifically Indigenous focused, but at the end of the day, we were just sort of catering for all dads and any dads that wanted to jump on board.
Yes, and what age were the children that you were dealing with in that program?
Oh, well, primary school age, say from 12 down to preschool age. And I wasn't just myself working on that program. There was Dr. Richard Fletcher and two other guys, Ken Bright and Craig Darcy. Craig Darcy came in with his skills as a early childhood teacher and director of a childhood, and Ken came in with his enthusiasm and also his skills as a social worker, and he's full of energy. So, I mean, we had a team around us, and that was, you know, it was a difficult time for us to try and engage not only the dads, but also try and engage the school to get them to think, well, why are dads important? Why do we need to get dads into the school?
And it isn't limited just to the biological dads, I presume. It extends to pops and uncles and older brothers.
Pops and uncles, older brothers. You know, there's a lot of single parent families out there, and most of them are mums. So, you know, she needs some sort of, you know, male influence in her life in terms of maybe she's got a brother or her father or the kid's grandfather maybe around where we can engage him in that male role with the children.
Yes. And do you think the Aboriginal fathers have perhaps lost some confidence in their fathering ability?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when you look at the history behind, you know, just Aboriginal people in general, you know, a lot of our roles were taken away from us, in terms of, you know, for the Stolen Generation and our roles there as you know, carers and providers. You know, but that, a lot of that has changed. You know, we moved on. Our roles have changed. A lot more of our partners are working. Our wives are working. So that, you know, if we're not working, that gives us more time to spend with our kids or our grandkids, and just society has sort of changed a little bit in terms of, you know, trying to engage with our children.
And what would you say was the traditional role for Aboriginal fathers?
Actually doing some interviews with some dads at the moment out in the Dubbo area, and Well, traditional times we were the hunters and gatherers and providers and that sort of stuff. Times have changed, but with the interviews that I'm conducting out of Dulwich at the moment, interviewing 10 dads out that way, and the main topic of discussion is coming out of that is that, you know, with my dad, for instance, and is that, you know, when we were growing up, he taught us the values of a work ethic, provide for your family, support your family, be there for your family, and that's one of the main points that is sort of coming out with all interviews that I'm doing with these dads.
Mm-hmm.
But then also a lot of the stuff that we're trying to get out there is that a lot of the dads now are looking to get more actively involved and pass on the skills of being a dad, the importance of being a dad, not just a carer, not just that work ethic, but instill some other positive things within your child's life in terms of how to look after your kid, you know, how to support them, how to nurture them, how to care for them, you know, because sometimes the mum's not going to be around, so then you've got to take that nurturing role on.
Yes, and do you encourage them to provide that cultural background?
Yes, you still keep that cultural touch in place. A lot of it's, you know, I mean, I never grew up in a cultural background where we had men and women's business. We weren't privileged enough to live like that. But in saying that, I still grew up in a strong cultural background of identity, who I am, where I'm from, who my family is, my people, my land.
Mm.
So I grew up with all that, but also because society changed, culture changes, so we've got to adjust with the times and the times of where us as men need to take that bit more fathering, nurturing role on. We can't leave it up to the mums to do it all.
Yes. Now, there's an Aboriginal word, I think, that describes what we're talking about. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it properly, but is it Kanyanimpa? Kanyanimpa?
Kanyanimpa. Sounds right, yep.
Now, it's roughly described as the role of adult men in healing or growing up the next generation. And that's something, I guess, that's really what you're involved in.
Yeah, the same sort of program type thing, you know, where we're working with these guys to appreciate their role as fathers and enjoy the time while they're dads.
Mm.
And connect with your children while they're young. They don't stay young forever. So, I mean, you know, I use a lot of my stuff with talk a lot of stuff about my own life. Like I'm a grandfather now.
Mm, congratulations!
And so happened, my granddaughter, she's one today.
Oh well, great.
So 20th of March. So I've trying to instill not just that work ethic into my own two sons, but also that. The importance of him being a good dad, being around for his daughter, providing for her, but also that nurturing side of life. Like my son went away for 3 days working, and she fretted severely for him, you know, and that. So I mean, he's got that close connection with his daughter, and. And even the mother noticed that, and she said, "No, you can't go away working for too long. Not while she's so little fretting for him, and that, you know." So they're the sort of things that we're trying to encourage young Aboriginal fathers, because a lot of Aboriginal families were raised by their grandparents. A lot of parents are still trying to make that connection back with their own children. So there's a lot of history within the parenting cycle of Aboriginal people.
Yeah, so you're trying to reintroduce the parents into that role that perhaps, what reason do you think the grandparents and uncles and aunties took over from the parents? Is that why did that happen? Or
well,
is that history?
Oh well, I think my mum and dad did it with two of my nieces and nephews, and you know, one's 27 now and the other's 16. I've seen it with my partner, with her mum and dad. They raised a few of the kids, and it's sort of just that cultural thing where my sister still had connection with mum and dad and their kids, but it was just a little bit that role of sometimes respect, like my sisters respected mum and dad, and you know, and they were doing a good job. And I think, you know, just they're the type of things that Aboriginal grandparents sort of just do. I think it's just a role that comes natural to a lot of grandparents, with Aboriginal people.
Yes. Sort of like it takes a village to grow a child. That sort of, is it more a community thing raising the child than perhaps we think of in Western society?
Yes. How I grew up, that's how it was on the mission that I grew up in, Mulmorey. That was sort of like how it was. Everybody sort of knew everybody, and you know, they knew who owned who, and you know, and sort of kept us on the right path.
Yep.
You know, back then, but you know, with the way society is today, that's sort of not the case with a lot of things that are happening in society, particularly the protection of young children. It's more aware now of protection and looking out for them.
Yes. So you really want to encourage the aunties and uncles and grandparents to get involved as well, rather than sort of pulling back and leaving it to just the parents, I suppose. Everyone really needs to be involved.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've got a large family. I've got, you know, six sisters and four brothers, but I'm still actively involved with a lot of my nephews and nieces. You know, just in conversation, you know, sometimes, you know, one of my sisters might ring up and say, I'm going to get uncle to talk to you and that sort of stuff. And so there's still that male influence in their life, you know.
Well, that's good. But keep you busy with six, you say six, we have 10 siblings, as I think you said.
Yeah, I've got 10, yeah, four older brothers, six younger sisters and one younger brother. Three older brothers, sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
That keeps me busy.
It would. Now, your experience is mainly in cities and perhaps regional, rather than you know, in the desert areas. Do you find is there a difference in dealing with the indigenous communities in the cities, say Newcastle, as distinct from back blocks of Western Australia?
Yeah, well, one of the main concerns within the Newcastle area is that it's geographically Aboriginal people spread out all over the place in Newcastle. It's not as small as some people seem it to be. We've got large Aboriginal population at different areas, and in terms of trying to engage them and run programs, you've got the distance, you know, they could take up to 40 minutes to get to one place to run a program, you know, and where you look at a regional area like, say, Moree or Tamworth, you know, like if it was to run something there, they got a very successful men's group at Tamworth there with Gary Crichton. You know, if it was to run a program through there with him, you know, I mean, most of the men probably only live 10 minutes away from the location, and to run stuff there, and then in terms of remote areas, I mean, I actually been to a few communities in the territory, on some little bit of work with World Vision a few years ago, and I mean, the language barrier is another thing, because you know they traditionally speak their own language. English is the second language, and you know, and they still practice the traditional ways of men and women's business, where where my main role is, you know, we're trying to engage the dads in right from the start of the pregnancy right through to the birth, where in where they still practice traditional law and that sort of stuff, that's a men and women's business. So it's a bit hard to try and, well, not hard, it's a no-go zone, so to speak, to try and talk to men in remote communities about the birth and all that sort of stuff, where that's women's business. So there is that barrier.
Yes, look, perhaps could you just explain to us a bit, I think I've got some understanding, but what really is men's business and what's women's business? What does that really mean?
Well, traditionally there's different areas of, I can't really speak on women's business because I'm not fully aware of what that is, but I mean, there's only certain areas that in traditional times that men actively got involved with their children, where like, say, for instance, like I went into, I was actually in the labour ward with my partner when she gave birth to our two boys. But men and women's business, that's not allowed.
No, in the traditional culture, you would not be allowed anywhere near the mother when she's having a child.
No, that's women's business. They go and do the birth and all that sort of stuff and take care of the baby to a certain period of time and then there's I'm not quite sure, but sometime later on the dad takes up his role and responsibility as a father. So, I mean, there's that there sort of discussion that takes place in traditional law up in the Territory or Western Australia where they still practice that sort. But we sort of can't hold that back because a lot of our young men and their partners are young and they need to be involved around the rural setting, like Newcastle, where the young couples sometimes have no one, the young lady mightn't have no one else to lean on, and she's got her partner there, so he's got to be involved.
Yes, and then a little bit later. Is there still a practice of initiation for boys becoming men?
I think so. I believe so in certain parts of Australia. I'm not quite, you know, sure. But I know people where they still do initiation in certain areas of Australia.
Mm. So that'd be more in the in the desert, the outback, and the
remote communities.
Yes, we're speaking with Craig Hammond, who's the leader of Indigenous Programs at Family Action Centre, University of Newcastle. Craig, you've also produced a DVD, I believe.
Yeah, I've produced a couple of DVDs. One's called "So Now You're a Dad." What I did there, I interviewed four first-time dads, mm-hmm. on their roles of being a father, the ups and downs, and what it was like to be actively involved with your partner. And they talked about that. They talked about connection, how they connect with their kids, you know, that sort of stuff. And that runs for about, I think about 7 minutes. We produced that here at the university, at Family Action Centre. We also did a DVD called "So the Skills and Strengths of Indigenous Pops, Uncles, Brothers." That was filmed in Newcastle. And what happened there was that we just filmed dads doing everyday things with their kids, playing in the park, changing them, cuddling them, reading them. But in that one, there's no talking. It's just images put to a song by Archie Roach, "Love in the Morning."
Yes.
And it's a pretty, a powerful image. And the words to the song really portrays the images. And what I say to people is that when they look at it, look at it through your eyes as a father or a grandfather or... You know, if a lady's watching it, look at it through. If you can see it through your partner's eyes,
yes.
you know, the importance of that connection, that role that we play, that we should be playing with our kids.
Yes. And the kids have some input too. I know it's some of your projects you've actually asked the kids, you know, what are the real things you'd like to do with your dad? What sort of answers do you get to that sort of question?
Yeah, well, it all depends on, you know, like the age group. I mean, you know, we spoke to primary school kids, and you know, they've just like to, you know, do more activity type things with their dads, and just to spend more time with them.
Mm.
And a lot of times too, it's they'd like to do stuff that they'd like to do with their dad, not specifically, yeah, a dad picking up a fishing rod and saying, let's go and fishing, where, you know, sometimes the kid might like fishing.
Yeah.
So a lot of the kids tend to, you know, I want to do something that I want to do, but I want to do it with my dad.
Mm.
You know, and then a lot of it's just, a lot of the times it's just about, they just want to spend time with them.
Yes.
Mm. You know, and just talk to them, and, you know, and then what we found too, that a few of the kids, you know, they just want to hear dad say that I love you. You know, and a lot of the, you know, it's hard, you know, it's hard for a lot of men are not supposed to cry, but I mean, nothing wrong with crying when you're holding your child or your granddaughter or grandson.
Yeah, I think there's some universal truths in that. Now, you've been also working with some dads who are in particularly difficult situations, the ones who are in jail or in correctional centres. That must present a whole lot of new challenges to keep that relationship going between the father and the children.
Yeah, I mean that was a challenge in itself. When I first started to go into the system there, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what it was like. You know, you hear all these stories about in jail and that sort of stuff, and you know, and they we've learned a lot in terms of our program and on how to deliver it and what worked and what didn't work and how the system works and that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, they're still dads.
Yeah.
You know, we don't go in there to judge them for why they're in there. We go in there to look at ways on how do they engage with their kids whilst inside. You know, we talk about communication. You know, how do they communicate with their child? I mean, they get 6 minutes on the phone to ring home or ring someone. What do they talk about? Or, you know, in a situation, if their young son or daughter picks up the phone, are they the person you want to talk to?
Mm.
What if they do? What do you do?
Yeah.
When you only got 6 minutes.
Mm.
I mean, you know, and I mean, there's a lot of struggle in there for them. They're trying to survive in an environment that's, you know, a harsh environment at its best.
Mm.
You know, and then try to think about, you know, their role as dads. But I mean, in saying all that, they do love their children, and it gives them an opportunity to talk openly about their relationship with their child in a setting where, you know, all the blokes in the room are Indigenous, and they all come from the same sort of background, and they all understand each other, and they feel comfortable talking openly about it, and they're not being judged by or a psychiatrist or, you know, anyone like that. They're just sitting around having a yarn, and it's an opportunity for them to talk openly and freely.
Yeah,
and say how they feel, and it does get a bit emotional in there.
Sure it would. Now, Berkey, you've prepared a report on Brothers Inside. You've got this DVD. For people who want to get more information, what's the best place for them to go to?
Well, they could either call me direct on 0249216821, or they could just go to the university or, you know, Google Family Action Centre.
Family Action Centre, yes.
Yep, and that'll take us to our website, and then it's got all our contact details and our resources and all that on show, so then we could take it from there.
Great. I mean, there's an excellent report I've seen here on the Brothers Inside Project on reflections on fathering workshops with Indigenous prisoners, so that's available. I think we could spend a lot more time talking about that, but Berkey, we're running out of time, and you've selected a song for us today which might take us out. I wonder if you could just tell us, you mentioned it already actually, but tell us again about your choice.
Oh, yes, I actually wrote your song, Love in the Morning. It's just a beautiful song, you know, great story, storyteller, songwriter, good Australian, and yeah, just love his music. And And it's when I put that DVD together with the first one, this pop, the Skills and Strengths Aboriginal Dads and Pops, Richard Fletcher said, well, what are we going to put it together to? And I said, well, Love in the Morning. And he said, oh, that's quick. You didn't even think about it.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I thought when I asked you too.
And that's, that's probably one of my best songs.
We're looking forward to it too. We're going to put it on right now. So, Craig Hammond, could we thank you very much for being on the program and giving us all those insights? It's been wonderful having you on, and we wish you all the best in your ongoing work.
Not a problem, and thank you very much.
And please say hello to Dr. Richard Fletcher. He's been a guest on our program before.
I shall. I've got a meeting with him at 2 o'clock, so.
That's great. All right. Craig Hammond, thanks again.
Thanks very much.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
When I see you. When I see you in the morning light, then I know everything will be alright. Yes, 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 darling, I love you so. Said I love you so. And when I hear you, oh, it sounds like song. And I know that you will make me strong. Yes, yes, yes. And together we will grow. Said that we will grow. Here in the afterglow.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
We're just about out of here. This is the last time we get to talk to you. That was Love in the Morning by Archie Roach, a selection of Craig Hammond. And we'd like to thank him, and we'd also like to thank Aaron Stewart, who was our first guest. We'll be back next... We'll be back on Tuesday, the 3rd of April. We've got a big show on Survivors and Mates Support Network. In the meantime, don't forget our web address, dadsontheair.com.au, where you can find us on Facebook, join us on Twitter. So until the 3rd of April, it's bye from Dads on the Air.
Yep, and bye from me as well. Ian Purdy signing off, and Bill Cable as well.
We're dead.